Hello and welcome to At the Pass. I'm your host, Adam Vetterell, and this is a show about the Ottawa restaurant scene for the Ottawa restaurant scene. I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to At the Pass. Today, my guest is Rob Nellis. He's the founder of Buyers and Sellers, a unique business model in Ottawa and something I'm very excited to talk about. Rob also teaches wine courses, and we've had him at North Navy to help expand wine knowledge of our team. That is where I met him, and I was impressed by his extensive knowledge, not just about wine, but about the politics and history of the regions that produce it. When COVID put a stop to everything, we were halfway through a course on the wines of Northern Italy, and it is one of the things that I'm really missing since everything got put on hold. Perhaps that's why I was so keen to get him on the podcast. This will have to serve as a stand-in for my weekly fix. Also, like many other people during this pandemic, my alcohol consumption has gone up significantly, and most of that has been wine. Every time I open a new bottle, I go through the tasting steps that I learned from Rob, so I've been thinking about him a lot. Rob, I'm excited to talk to you. I'm really excited to hear more about Buyers and Sellers, but before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the industry and ended up making wine and hospitality your way of earning a living?
Thanks, Chef. Wonderful to chat with you. And yeah, I miss our tastings as well. We're going to hook that back up as soon as we can get out of lockdown, for sure.
That cannot come fast enough.
Agreed. So I've been in wine and hospitality for a long time. I was started in the dish pit when I was about 14 years old and did some old school bussing back when you used to have to do some ironing of the linens and such. Bounced around a little bit. Yeah, man, it's much better now. But then I really cut my teeth in the hospitality industry as a doorman in Hull. Back in the day on the strip, working at places like City Club, which is Chez Henri, where, you know, the bucket of blood every night after all the fights and that sort of thing. But it gives you a real quick learning curve for dealing with the public. After a few years, I was doing a little bit of side bartending, and I met a winemaker, sat at the bar one day, and then we did some tastings of his wine. He was doing some sampling. Now, it was garbage wine back in the day from Ontario, but I seemed to have a little bit of a palate, and I took a part-time job at Wine Rack. Okay. And fast forward a few years, and they had put me through some wine courses, and I became one of their company sommeliers. And then I became part of Enniskillen and Jackson Triggs sommelier team. And then they put me through more courses. And I discovered that shifting from bartending and serving to being a sommelier brought in more money. And that ultimately, front of house is all about money, right?
Yes.
And the more you know about wine, the more you earn. And then that started me towards the discovery. And then I started to realize that I really, really liked wine. I mean, I was the same as every young guy in Canada back in the 90s. I enjoyed my rye and I enjoyed my beer. Wine was kind of a side thing at the time. But then I really started to lean into the wine thing. And then I started to take official wine courses as opposed to these little short ones. And the Wine Spirit Education Trust came along. I found that I had a real acumen for it. And I became an instructor, and now 13 years of instructing later, and I've taught over 1,000 people. I wanted to do something a little bit different than restaurants. My body started to give out on me. Anybody who's worked in restaurants long enough, I'm closing in on 50. I'm on the dark side of the 40s. So I found some investors that were willing to take the plunge with me, and we decided to open a little bit of a wine agency. And here we are today.
So that's what the principal business model for Buyers and Sellers. It's a wine agency. So you guys will be importing wines and selling them, but you also have like a tasting room in there. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So we're opening a tasting room in Ottawa. We're in the final phases. We were about to roll it out just before COVID hit. No sob story here. We're all dealing with the same thing. But the whole concept behind it is you can try everything that's in our portfolio for a very affordable price in luxurious surroundings. I'm a champagne taste on beer budget type of guy, and our tagline is affordable luxury. I love to wear shorts and a t-shirt, but be in really nice surroundings when I do it. So, like most people, I don't have the money to spend all the time. But we wanted something where people can sit down in a truly immersive experience to taste wine. Nothing like this exists in Ottawa. It's not that we don't have great wine bars, because we do, but there's no markup on our wine, just enough to keep the lights on. So you can come in, try 5 different 1 ounce samples and leave with a private appointment for about $20. And, wow. And the other thing we want to do is we're not a competition for restaurants or wine bars. Our concept is to do private tastings, which was ahead of the curve considering what's about to go down.
Yeah.
But the private tastings are before you go to dinner somewhere or as an aperitif, just before, instead of doing that one first glass of wine at the restaurant, you do 5 samples, go hit the restaurant and have a wonderful dinner. So we want to kind of tie into the restaurants and help support them, while giving a place where it's solely about wine. It's not about food. It's about the wine itself.
That's such an interesting concept. Did you sort of see that somewhere else and get inspired, or is this just something you dreamed up?
Kind of a little bit of both. One was went out to Washington State when we were doing this, and Seattle's known for its urban wine rooms. And okay. I visited a bunch in Washington. Didn't do enough in Seattle, but we were out in wine country and they had some beautiful tasting rooms, and they kind of try to outdo each other on their tasting rooms. And then that in Vegas, they've had some curated little shops. Think of it like trying to buy your wedding dress, where you sit down and people parade stuff out to you. That's the sort of concept that I was looking for wine.
Yeah.
I also really wanted it a place where there's no, like, even our hand soaps are unscented. There's no extraneous odors, where you can taste wine in the perfect atmosphere with the proper glassware. It's not about pretension at all, but we have big screen TVs where you can see the vineyards while you taste. We're gonna do some stuff with virtual reality as well. We're gonna try that down the line and see how that works. Slap the glasses on and like you're in the vineyard.
I feel like right now that's probably the direction you want to be pushing in, since no one's allowed to go near each other.
Yeah, that's this could be a benefit to our particular business model. This is going to be a money losing prospect, having this tasting room. It's not going to move the needle for the company, but it's something that I really wanted to bring to Ottawa. Toronto gets all the fun stuff. We know that. In Ottawa, I wanted to have something a little bit different, fun for the Ottawa wine people.
Yeah, well, that's kind of why I'm so excited about it. It's like such a unique business model, and it's the kind of stuff you only see in other cities, it seems. But gradually, Ottawa is getting more and more stuff like that. So it's really interesting to me. Is all the wine in your cellar curated by you? Or are you the principal buyer?
Yeah, I really wanted to control the wines. I'm all about elegance and a deft touch. I don't like the big, juicy, heavily oaked, boozy kind of wines. That's not my style. I understand why people like them, and there's a market for that, and there's lots of agencies that do fantastic work with it. Same thing with some of the natural wines that are coming out. I have no problem with the wine being natural. I'm not as into the unclean style. I understand the love of Brettanomyces. It's a little bit funky, a little bit cool. But there's other agents that are doing fantastic work. What I'm looking for is, I hate to use the term, but feminine wines, a little bit higher acid, mm-hmm. purity of fruit. So I love wines from elevation. You know that, Jeff. About that. I love wines from up in the mountains. I love wines that have that crystal clear kind of fruit flavor where you can pick out individual notes. And I love wines that make you want to have another glass. I don't like anything you need a toothbrush after you have a glass of it.
Yeah, so you're looking to build a portfolio of wines that fit sort of within like a narrow band of the wine spectrum.
That's right.
That's something you're trying to like become known for is those sort of wines. So I guess you kind of already answered the next question I was going to ask, but what kind of wines are you drinking during the COVID crisis?
Oh man. Aside from tons, I'm really like Northern Italy is my passion, much like yourself. And mm-hmm. I'm also really into Slovenian wines and Croatian wines. So I've been doing a lot of Barbera, a little bit of Gavi, which I have a beautiful Gavi in the portfolio, shameless shameless pitch right there. But we also have some Rebula from Slovenia, which is Rebola Gialla. And I think Slovenia is the next area, and Croatia are the next area to pop. And I want to be ahead of the curve there.
I always wondered why there weren't more wines from that area, because it has similar terroir to like Northern Italy. And also all the oak comes from that part of the world. Like all the barrels come from there. So you'd think at some point the coopers in those areas would be like, well, we're making the equipment to make the wine. Why don't we just make the wine right here?
A few reasons. One was a lot of the wines were rustic for the longest time. When it was under Tito, there was no investment. And then when the Soviets had it, it was all about producing bulk, lots of alcohol. Mm-hmm. As much yield as you can get from a vineyard. Much like what happened down in Chile under Pinochet, there wasn't investment, or South Africa under apartheid. Once that lifted, they've really invested in the area, and they've changed their wines dramatically. The other thing that's happened is that people in North America don't recognize the names, so they're kind of scared to try them. They're worried about dropping. They can be a little bit more expensive because the freight from that area is a little bit more expensive. So what we see in our marketplace is either too expensive, or they're wines of poor quality so that they can hit a price point.
But that seems to be a good recipe for like a burgeoning wine region, is if it starts by just making like quantity, and that's their focus at the beginning, it puts a huge amount of land under vine. And then if the economic and political situation changes enough, suddenly there's incentive to create a better product, and you already have the vines, so it's just about refining them and using different techniques. So maybe that, I guess that's probably why you feel like it might be the next big big area. It's sort of like the new Portugal and the new Spain.
Well said. Absolutely. Portugal is another region that I'm really leaning into. I love the wines from there. I love the people from there. I just love the country itself. Mm-hmm. And I think especially the whites, I mean, people think of Portugal and they always think red, unless you've been in Portugal and it's 45 degrees Celsius in the shade, and understand why whites, they like whites. Their food lends itself towards more whites than reds. And they're the best wines, in my estimation, that aren't port coming out of the region are the Barrancos. They're whites. They're so kick-ass. Obviously, I love those high acid wines. The wines are surprisingly bright and fresh, even in the heat. I love those wines.
To take it back to Croatia, I was just wondering, is there a specific grape to Croatia? Like, do they have a native grape, or is it all like imported from France after the blight?
They do. They have a few indigenous. So Gradiška Vina, which isn't just from Croatia, it's also from Austria. It's known as Welsh Riesling in Austria, but that's kind of their signature white. They have a grape called Frankovka, which is also known as Blaufränkisch in Austria.
Okay,
and I've had that. I mean, Frankovka is think of Beaujolais on steroids. so it's got a little bit of that spicy character. It's got that red fruit. It's not particularly heavy. If you want a big brawny grape, they've got Plava Chmali, which on the Dalmatian coast, which is in the Zinfandel family. It's not Zinfandel, but it's in that kind of family. And I don't particularly like it as much. That's just my own personal opinion. I prefer the Frankovka. And they're doing a lot of work. It's not indigenous, but with Cabernet Franc.
Really?
It grows really well there, surprisingly. So I think you're going to see a little bit more Cab Franc. I'll say worldwide right now, Cab Franc is getting some love. They're planting it up at elevation in South America, but which I'm super excited about.
Yeah, that's sort of right up your alley.
Right up my alley. Yeah, just as an aside, I'm dealing with a winery from Bolivia right now, and these guys are sweethearts. I just love chatting with them. I was talking with them one day, and the whole country was falling apart. And all that they were caring about is how I was doing. Like Morales had lost the government, Evo Morales, and they had armed people walking through the streets. They had blackout blinds, hiding from these militias and that sort of thing. And he's giving me a call to see how I'm doing. Love these guys. Cannot wait to get their wines in the country.
I find one of the things I really like about your wine classes is you always bring so much history and like knowledge about the regions of the wine, and it is really important to the wine, but that's what I find interesting. And I studied that in university, a lot of stuff like that. So to me, it puts it in a place, and it's a lot easier for me to remember certain facts about the wine if there's a broader context around it. Is that something you studied before? Like, do you have, like, I feel like you have like a PhD in history when I listen to you talk about wine.
Yeah. Thanks for that. You know what? I'm into politics, and I'm really into history, have been my whole life. And I love food and wine. And to me, part of what attracts me to the food and wine business is the history of it. And it's the same thing with chefs. When you start talking about why certain foods are served and why they're served in certain regions, it's the same thing with wine. I think that without understanding the region, you can't understand the wines. I look for wines that show terroir. It's the most overused term on the planet because you can kind of adjust terroir. But for me, and I've said this in class, terroir is also the people of the region, the food of the region, and the people who are making the wine. They're all part of that terroir. And I think it's important to understand the fabric of history that went into creating these wines. There's a reason why these wine regions exist. I'll look at Valdosta up in the Alps, and you can see where the Romans 2,000 years ago hacked out from the mountain these little plateaus where there was some sand and planted this lonely vineyard of Pinot Noir on the side of a mountain. And understanding that there was a fort about 50 feet away, this old abandoned 2,000-year-old fort where they're watching the Alp passes. And that, to me, is really cool that to this day we're still growing wine grapes in that area.
Yeah. Love it.
I nerd out on it.
The thing I think about with both food and wine at a high level, they're both luxuries. Like it's something a society has to earn by creating peace and creating the conditions to elevate your food and your wine. And so if you don't understand the history, you'll never understand how a society got to the point where they could make really good wine or really good food. But when things fall apart, people just stop caring, you know, suddenly now food is just a way to not die. And alcohol is just a way to forget about how crappy everything is. So when it's done at a high level, you have to understand how you got to that point in the first place.
It's exactly that. Wine becomes an afterthought. I'll use the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon as an example. Every time Israel and Lebanon go to war, they march right through that valley, and you know all wine production stops. I was supposed to go to Algeria and Tunisia last year in the summer to go find a couple of wineries down there, and then Algeria's government fell, and now it's on it's in Islamic rule, and I can't even communicate right now with some of the wineries that I was talking to. I deal with Jordanian wines, so I'm the only importer of wines from Jordan. There's only two wineries there, and it's 10 kilometers from the Syrian border, where the largest refugee camp in the world is. So it's a really cool area. Wine is an afterthought there. The other thing I'll say is we add the pretension to wine. When you meet winemakers, they aren't pretentious. They'll drink straight out of the bottle happily in a field with you. We add those elements. At its root, wine is peasant. Wine was the drink of peasants. It was simple and easy to grow, easy to make. We added all of this and turned it into something that is seen as elitist. When you travel the world, it's not elitist. Wine is just a part of everyday life, as is food.
Yeah, I remember reading once that after the Roman Empire fell in the Dark Ages, over half of all calories consumed by Italians was in the form of wine. So it wasn't. they were not drinking like, you know, Slovenian oaked, blah, blah, blah. They were just, you know, it was for sustenance because the water wasn't clean enough and it was just cheap calories, basically.
100%. And I want to get us back to that point where we look at wine as part of an everyday diet. I understand there are some people that can't drink alcohol or won't drink alcohol. That's fine. But those of you who can, add wine into the diet. It's economies of scale here. If we drank more wine, the prices would change. Supply and demand.
I also find one of the great things that's going on in the market in Ottawa and probably North America in general is an appreciation of the better wines. Like for a while, you could only get sort of really full body, really jammy reds and really high oaked, really sweet whites. And now there seems to be a desire for kind of the wines that you really specialize in, which is higher acid, more elegant fruit. longer finishes, and then also stuff like the natural wines, which everyone seems to be learning a lot about and coming around. So just from your point of view, describe how you saw that evolve, and when was the first time you realized that you could probably put together a wine list that wasn't, you know, full of these jammy reds and sweet whites?
So I've been in the wine industry in Ottawa a long time, and you're right. For the longest time, people just gravitated towards, despite the fact they think it's dry wines, they wines with residual sweetness, the yellowtails of the world. Mm-hmm. Say what you want about yellowtail, though. That was a whole generation, the Xers, that gravitated towards wine because they started to package it in attractive packaging and made it put training wheels on the wine. So I hated it at the time, and I thought it was the worst thing to ever happen, much like Pinot Grigio now and things like that. But whatever makes people come into the wine world is good with me. And I'll say Ottawa has more wine knowledgeable people per capita, I think, than anywhere in the world. We have a lot of great training programs in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. You know, the Vendange Institute, my boy Norm McAvoy and Louise doing their thing for over a decade now. You got the Algonquin program, which has been fantastic. And that's really brought a lot of people into the wine scene. There's a few other people running some schools. There's a lot of work with the quartermaster sommeliers. And of course, we got some great wine bars. We have a lot of wine knowledgeable people, and they weren't really served by a lot of the lists that were out there, including restaurant lists. But for the last decade or so, I've seen like a steep learning curve, and it's the trajectory is outstanding. People are willing to spend a little bit more. Those interesting wines, they cost more to make. They're from regions that aren't particularly easy to freight from, so you pay for that. But people are willing to do that. We'll see after all this whether that's the case.
I've had a few conversations during the pandemic about sort of the industry as a whole and stuff, and everything has to be like couched in, well, at least that's the way it used to be. I have no idea what it's going to be like when all this is over.
Oh, brother, it's breaking my heart, man. I still hang out in the restaurant scene, and there's a lot of my friends that are looking at whether or not this is a viable enterprise for them, and it's crushing. I really hope people come back and support the restaurants, even though it's going to be a little bit weird at first. Spend some of that money. Yes, some people took a hit financially, but some people have just been banking it. From one of people I've been talking to, some have saved money while this is going down because they're not out blowing it on stupid stuff.
Yeah,
support local.
I've been trying to stay as optimistic as possible, and I'll tell anyone who listens that that's what I think is going to happen. I don't actually know if that's true or not, but I think, yeah, especially in Ottawa, there's so many people still collecting paychecks, so when all this is over, I think they're going to be hungry to get in a space and talk about wine and stand less than 2 meters away from a stranger and just, you know, get back out. So I'm refusing to think of anything else besides that's how it's going to be, because basically that's what because if it doesn't turn out like that, then there's nothing I can do about it and I'm screwed anyway. So there's no sense in, you know, it's not like,
we like to eat in restaurants as North Americans. I read at one point Montreal had more restaurants per capita than Paris did. I mean, we like to dine. Not necessarily the most educated palates sometimes, because we are Canadian and we like things that have been deep fried. Nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. I'm Canadian. I'm a little bit porky, so of course I like deep fried stuff too. But I honestly believe that in a government town like this, that we are a little bit more recession proof. And I think 2008 proved that. Maybe the days of the high-end fine dining have gone the way of the dodo. I was with Mina Restaurant, and we, you know, it just didn't take, despite sterling reviews, a little bit out of the price point for most people in Ottawa. But I think that mid-tier or casual upscale dining like you guys do is going to bounce back nicely. I'm kind of banking on it.
Yeah, me too. 100%. I just like, I can't think of anything else. There's no point. So that's how it's going to be. When you made the wine list for Mina, I never got the chance to eat there, which really upset me. But that's a unique opportunity because it was a tasting menu restaurant. So it gave you like this great opportunity where you could introduce people to these interesting wines. Like I still keep drinking that La Crête Valdost Chardonnay, which I think is like one of the best white wines I think I've ever tasted in my life. And that's the sort of thing with a tasting menu that you get a chance to show people, because anyone who drinks that's going to love it, but it's probably not the sort of thing like we have it at North and Navy, but it's rare anybody would just thumb their finger down the list and be like, that's the wine I want. You would need to have somebody explain to you exactly why it's so impressive and how hard the vines are to get at. And you know, the 2000 year old steps built by the Roman Empire and stuff. So I know you do a lot of work helping people build wine lists. How do you instruct people to build a wine list that has enough interesting stuff like that? Or do you go all in or do you sort of balance it out a little bit?
So when you're talking about hand sales like that, you can't build your entire list like that because you have to make your clientele comfortable. And you can come off as pretentious if all you have is esoteric wines that you really got to kind of wrap your head around. You look like a jackass. You got to kind of weave them in with stuff that they recognize. But for me, what I chose to do instead is I look for interesting wines from a region. So if I was going to serve a Californian wine, I'm going to go find somebody who's doing some cutting edge stuff to really bring up purity of fruit, who's planting in vineyards and reducing yields and using some techniques from Burgundy, perhaps. If I'm doing something from Northern Italy, from an area like Veneto, I'm going to look for somebody that's doing something with autochthonous varietals or indigenous varietals, as opposed to going to an Amarone. The other thing that a tasting menu allowed me to do was work on one of my real passions, which is food and wine pairing. Our chef, James Bratsberg, at the time, really liked to work with Japanese styles and using umami elements, which is absolutely deadly to wines unless you find wines that have umami. So that was kind of cool because I went around the world looking for little pockets where they have some iron-rich soil, like Coonawarra in Australia, or little pockets in Napa where you can find these kind of savory, meaty notes, Sangiovese with age. Bordeaux's that are kind of Merlot heavy that have a little bit of age as well, bringing out some of those umami notes.
Well, actually, I was just thinking that it just popped into my head, but I get a lot of umami from a lot of red natural wines. And I find typically that natural wines are hard to pair with food for a couple of reasons, but mainly because they change quite a bit. Just because if you get a case and you taste a bottle at the beginning, and then leave it in the cellar for a month, it might taste totally different the next time you open it. So it's hard to say.
Bottle variants too.
But that just popped into my head that if I was pairing with like, because Italian food actually has a lot of umami, like tomato is full of umami. Parmesan is like the biggest umami hit you can get.
Mushrooms, man.
Yeah. So I was just sort of thinking out loud, I guess.
One of the worst paired foods on earth is bolognese. People think, oh, it's red sauce and meat. It's easy. And then you taste your wine and it tastes like brushing your teeth and drinking orange juice. It's just thin and sour. And you got to find bolognese is actually really difficult to pair with. Marinara is really difficult to pair with. And you got to have a talented somm who knows what they're doing. You do, but you got to have a talented somm that knows what they're doing to pair to that properly. Mushrooms are a lot of fun to pair with, but they can also do some deadly things to your wine. You have some really badass natural wines on your list, though.
The selection of natural wines is getting a lot better. Like at the beginning, when it was just sort of this hipster thing, there was some weird stuff out there, and I think a lot of people were drinking it just for the sake of drinking it. But now there's stuff that's done by like very, very talented winemakers and it's really complex and really interesting. And to them, it's just a new trick in their toolbox. It's just this extra thing they can do, and they can bring out fruit in a different way. And so it's getting really exciting. But you just have to put yourself in the hands of someone who like Alex at Arlo, which is going to open up hopefully at the same time you open up right after this
across
pandemic.
Across the street from me, man.
Yeah, so that'll be an interesting, you guys, I think you guys will both share in common like these curated wine lists that are very specific to the curator's taste. And I think that's going to be really exciting, just to people who know a lot about wine telling you, okay, this is the stuff I really like. And I think that's awesome. So somebody who's a novice doesn't have to feel intimidated, can just go in knowing full well that whatever they get is going to be delicious. I think that's super exciting.
Yeah, put your faith in the sommeliers. I mean, our business, especially in Ottawa, has been so incestuous for so long. People just hop from restaurant to restaurant. But there are some sommeliers that have shown that kind of loyalty and really dug into some restaurants, and they've been there for a while. And if you trust them, let them take you on an adventure. Let them try some different things. I always used to say, and I always had the support of the owners, try this. If you don't like it, take it off your bill and we'll sell it by the glass. You got to be very flexible to do that sort of thing. One out of every 20 people that I do that to would actually not enjoy it. I don't do that until I find out what they normally drink. And I try to do an experiment with that. If they tell me that they like leaner whites, for the most part, they won't say that, of course. They'll say things like, I like dry whites and I drink Pinot Grigio from Northern Italy. Okay, well, let's try and branch out from that. I think a lot of people are scared of fruit too. They think that off dry wines or wines with a little bit of residual are childish, or a lot of the older guys think that they're somehow womanly to drink a wine with residual sweetness. But man, I can drink Riesling every day, all day long.
Yeah,
no problem with fruit. It's made of fruit. Why are we trying to get away from that? And I find when, especially you were talking about the pairing menu, when you give people a little bit of fruit, they're actually pretty happy with it.
Yeah.
They'll tell you things like, oh, I always hated Riesling because it was too sweet.
But there's a big spectrum of Rieslings. And I think that's sort of I guess that's your whole job, is like informing people that there's different boxes and different grapes depending on where they're grown and how they're grown and who handles them and what happens to them after. There's so much variance in the flavors. So it's
we sit on our back steps, or we sit on the deck and we drink beer in Canada, and there's nothing wrong with that. And part of the problem is a lot of the people who are drinking beer, when they drink wine, they drink tannic red wines, and you don't want to sit out on your back deck and drink a Barolo, as much as I love Barolo, but that's not what it's for. But if you take, I'll use Grassa Vigna as an example. It's a high acid, kind of, it almost tingles on the tongue, and you can get it with a little bit of residual sweetness. I mean, you can chug that stuff. That's a velocity drink. You can just sit out outside and hammer that back. And that's to me, that's what I'm looking for, is to introduce people to the fact that wine can be drank the same way you drink beer. I love beer, by the way. I'm not trashing beer.
Yeah, I find that the wines that are popular, especially Italian wines that people know, the big Barberas, the Barolos and stuff, the Amarones, the bigger they are, they're quite difficult to pair with food. Unless you're cooking like specific dishes from those regions, and those dishes tend to be really heavy. And if you're trying to create a balanced menu, something with, especially in the summer when there's lighter things, it's sort of cringy when people sit down and they order like an heirloom tomato salad and sardines in a vinegar sauce and all these like light traditional dishes. And then they order this giant wine and you're just like, oh man, you're not going to taste any
California
of that.
Cab. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're doing it wrong.
so it puts anyone coming up with a wine list in this weird position. It's like, you got to have these, like, tick these boxes, these big bangers, because they bring in big money and stuff. But it's frustrating because, inevitably one of those wines is going to ruin it. Not that it ruins it for the person. If the person likes it, then that's fine. Go nuts. But just from like a nerdy, like chefy sommelier point of view, it's like, oh, I really wish you're not drinking that wine with that food, because it's not going to be a good time.
You work front of house long enough, and I've spent 30 years almost on the floor, man. You see, most people don't actually drink the wine with the food. They drink it before the meal comes. They hammer the food into their face, then they start drinking again. They rarely stop, put the fork down, and take another sip. We know that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
When you talk about the pairing all I want, they're not pairing.
No, it does. Yeah, they're just. And then when they do take a sip, it's just because they put too much food in their mouth and they need to sort of like loosen things up.
Yeah, I'm that guy too, though, man. I like to use a shovel to eat. But
I remember reading this thing that like when you ask people what kind of coffee they like, they use words like nutty and robust and dark. And so they think they want a dark roast. That's what like 90% mm-hmm. of people in North America will tell you. But then when they do blind tastings, what they all like is like a medium to light roast. Because roasting coffee really dark brings out bitterness, and North Americans don't like bitter.
They don't.
And so the marketers have to basically lie. They have to tell that they learn, like tell them they're getting this, but actually give them that and they'll be happier. And I find sometimes certain wines get that sort of pigeonhole. Like when you tell someone, or if someone tells you that they like Barolo, a lot of times they're thinking about this like really jammy, big, like oaky wine. And then you drink real Barolo and it's nothing like that. It's quite a light wine. It's very high acid. And you're just, like, but they love it. They'll drink it and they love it. And you're just like, well, that's not what you described. I'm glad you like it, but it's not what you think it is.
I get people tell me I like a really dry wine. Well, what the hell does that mean to begin with? But and then they'll tell you that their usual drink is Apothic Red. And I'm like, no, you're not drinking dry wine. You like fruit. Don't be afraid of the fruit. This is what you like. You use Barolo as an example. I've had people order Barolo and hate it.
Yeah.
Because they think they should be ordering Barolo. I'm like, that's an advanced palate that can really enjoy a young Barolo. This mm-hmm. will peel the enamel off your teeth. Now, I'm all in on Barolo. Don't get me wrong. I just don't have a budget. I have that goes back to that beer budget to drink it all the time. But, people don't actually like it frequently.
So is that part of the training of a sommelier is to learn to listen for those key words? So somebody will give you cues, like they're telling you what they think they like, but you can figure out what they actually like based on what they say and not be pretentious about it, but just sort of get them a wine that they're going to enjoy.
Yeah, like we all in the wine industry shit all over Pinot Grigio. And despite the fact that there's a wide range of flavors of Pinot Grigio and styles, but we do that simply because it's become a default for people. And what they're talking about frequently is insipid wines that are almost flavorless. And what they're looking for is basically a lighter style white. And you can try to get them to try different things. Sometimes that they're just going to drink a Pinot Grigio. I think when I was a little bit younger, I used to not put one on the list just to make people drink other things. And I kind of changed. Instead of not providing Pinot Grigio, I just provide a better quality version of it.
Well, since half my family is from Venice, I have to stick up for Pinot Grigio.
And right?
You can find good examples. It's like anything else. It's like, but yeah, it's because that part of Italy is just, everything's under vine. Like everywhere you go, there's vines. Yeah. And it's like, you look at the Massey production facility and it looks like an airplane hangar. It's humongous. And so they're just pumping out volume and stuff. But within that, there is people doing like really, really refined versions. They're always going to be a lighter wine. But you'll get nice fruit, and the good ones have really, really high acid, which is awesome for food pairing.
Well, they're lighter stylistically on purpose. Pinot Gris from Alsace is oily and heavy and rich. It's the same grape. They purposely harvest early with the acid still high. They don't let them respire to keep it fresh and lively. And that's just the style of the region. I'll also say it's a lot warmer there than it is in Alsace as well. So it kind of fits what they want to sip on. You use Massey. Santa Margherita is another one that has done a little bit of a disservice to the region. While I shouldn't say that, because they've also brought attention to the region.
Yeah, they're the yellowtail of Italy.
Exactly. And I always catch myself because I want to crap all over them, but I shouldn't, because they do a good job of making people drink wine as long as people venture forth from it. I don't understand why you drink the same beer and the same wine all the time. You don't eat the same food all the time.
Yeah.
I don't get why people get stuck on that.
The other service that those giant wineries provide that I think gets lost sometimes is the smaller like boutique wineries that have like a tiny amount of space under vine, and especially the ones that are looking to create vintages, which I've heard you say are going to go the way of the Dodo, which I want you to talk about after. But but the ones that are looking to produce high quality wines, they don't get great grapes every year. And when they don't, when it doesn't meet their standards, they can sell it to those giant producers. And so it makes their business viable. If you want the little guys to exist, you need the big guys, because when they sell bulk grapes to somebody, that just bankrolls the operation. So that way, 2 years from now, when they do get a good season, they make that amazing vintage that you love. Well, the reason they got there is because they sold their crappier grapes, you know, year one and year two.
You got it, man. Look at Mission Hill. So Mark Anthony built their fortune off of Mike's Hard Lemonade, which allowed them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, man. Dear little secret. I shouldn't say that. I'm now the competitor. Crap all over me. But they used that to build a gorgeous winery in Mission Hill, which is putting out some outstanding wines and helped to grow the BC wine region. So sometimes, same thing with restaurants. You know, people will build their money off of doing some volume places, and then they get to play with the really handcrafted stuff.
Oh, that's what you're supposed to do. Damn it. Why didn't you tell Chris and I that earlier? Let's start with the fancy one. Stupid. Yeah.
You guys have done all right. You did well. I'm sure the 20-hour days for a decade didn't hurt, but yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice little experiment. And we'll see if COVID allows it to continue.
You guys are an institution now.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. And I'm going to change the subject because I'm blushing. So I've definitely heard you say that you think vintages are going the way of the dodo. And I couldn't remember, it was also in a conversation about global warming, and that's sort of something to take our mind off the current pandemic. Let's all think about the imminent death that we're facing through global warming.
Sure, let's panic about something else.
Yeah, and how the wine world is sort of seeing the effects of it. Sort of, they're like the canary in the coal mine. So if you just want to expand on that a little bit.
So I don't think all vintages will disappear, but I think you're going to see a lot of houses work with multi-vintage wines, non-vintage wines. And that's to create kind of a house style. And I think you'll see some of their ultra premiums, and it's already working towards that. Will be non-vintage. I look at an area like California, which used to be extremely consistent, and they're seeing some wide variance between vintages. I'll look at a place like Northern Italy, where 2017 was wildly different in Tuscany than 2018 and 2016. 2017, the wines are very rough. Tough to drink, a little bit more tannic. I know they're going to flesh out over time, but that's not what the consumer wants. So as a house style, it's nice to be able to take some of the plusher, fruitier vintages, mix it in with that really tough tannic vintage that's got high acid, and you get something that's better than the sum of its parts. And I think that as we see these wild temperature variations, and worse than that, you start to see fall storms that didn't happen before. You're starting to see frosts in the northern climates in May that reduce yields significantly. There are some years where yields are huge and you're sitting on juice, and instead of trying to cellar some of the stuff that isn't worth it, you can keep it in tank and blend it from vintage to vintage. I don't know that it's all going to be like that, but there are some, especially some of the more continental climates, that this would be very beneficial to them. And we're already starting to see it.
I was wondering, like, as sort of the traditional wine areas like France and Italy are having, it seems like they're just struggling. Like every year seems like there's some new catastrophe, crazy hailstorms, early frosts. It's every season something. And I'm wondering if in North America, where we were sort of like at the upper level of the latitude where, you know, vineyards could exist, but maybe we'll move into a sweet spot as they move out of their sweet spot, which would be great for our wine producers, but horrible for the history of...
It really is. There's good and bad with that warmth, because what happens is sometimes the vines will wake up and you'll start to get that bud burst early, which is great, except we still get that cold snap, and that's worse. You'd rather have your vines dormant with a later start at that point than to have that early thaw where the vine believes that it's time to start waking up and producing fruit, and it's not ready for it yet. So there are some dangers with that. It's funny you mentioned France, because Bordeaux just allowed, 15 new varietals.
Yeah,
into Bordeaux. They've just seen that their old famous five isn't going to work with the new modern climate.
Yeah, it's crazy when you talk to, I'm sure you talk to a lot more winemakers than I do, but even the few that I get to speak to at the restaurant, it's basically the first thing they start talking about when you start asking about the production process and stuff. It's just like, well, because of global warming, we've had to do X, Y, and Z. And it's so alarming that, like, you know, especially sometimes it seems like there's still a debate and no one really knows what to do about it. But it is happening. And you talk to people who just rely on the environment to be consistent to produce whatever product they're producing. And they're the first to tell you, well, it's basically getting harder and harder every year.
Chef, you can't use the term global warming, because you're going to have some fucking hillbilly tell you that it's cold outside. You got to use the term climate change.
Oh, yes. Sorry. My mistake.
Sorry.
I studied environmental science in university, and I was there right during the debate. Like, when I was studying, it wasn't established science, which that just shows how old I am. What's been scary for me to witness is when we were learning about it back then, there was lots of different models of how it was going to play out. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's been worst case scenario. Like, the people who used to be regarded as the lunatics, the sky is falling, those people have all been validated. Like, it's, that's how fast it's going. So it's stressing me out.
I mean, we had what, 4 tornadoes in a day in Ottawa? When the hell have we seen that? That's in Dunrobin, it touched down, tore up a neighborhood. My director of communications had her van picked up and smashed down on Craig Henry. Like, this is not normal. This is not business as usual.
Yeah, this is not Kansas. You
know. No, man. This is the Ottawa Valley. Yeah, we got the old, the odd storm, but man. I remember in the 80s, acid rain, both sides of the border, we all got together. We're like, yeah, acid rain is bullshit. It's killing the fish. We know that this is, we can see the froth washing up on our private lakes that we love. Let's do something about it. But all of a sudden it became political to address pollution. And I don't get it. When did pollution become political? Yeah, nobody likes it.
It seems like it should be an easy, like, it's not going to be easy to solve the problem. Obviously it involves like a complete upheaval of how we produce everything basically, but at least it should be easy to get everyone on side that it's a problem and we got to do something about it. It's crazy that you have to convince people there's a problem when it's right under your nose.
Well, I mean, it's not under the nose. This is the problem, because to most of these people, they don't think long-term. Everything is totally reactionary. They think of today. They assume climate is the weather outside their window. They don't see long-term things like droughts in Africa as being their fault. It's not their fault. I shouldn't use that term. Our fault as a society, as a civilization. They're like, well, this is just, you know, this just happens. Even if we're wrong, even if you and I are totally wrong, what's worst case scenario? We're creating less pollution. That's a bad thing.
Yeah, that's what I always thought was strange. It's like actually in Montreal in 1994 they signed the Montreal Protocol, which banned ozone depleting chemicals, and we closed the hole in the ozone layer. And yeah, there was way less science to prove that there was a hole in the ozone layer when they signed that. All the hard evidence that it was happening came after, but they signed it anyways to exercise the precautionary principle. And it would be nice to see a little bit of that now. And maybe I'm going to continue to be an optimist, and I'm going to say maybe this pandemic will kind of wake everyone up. It'll show us the importance of working together, show us the importance of institutions, federal institutions, global institutions, and remind everyone that we're all on the same little rock flying through space, so we got to get our shit together.
Oh, listen to you, you hippie, you globalist.
Oh, I'm a globalist.
One world government.
Wow, I didn't think we were going to solve all the world's problems in my podcast, but look at us, we just did. So pat yourself on the back.
That's because I'm very smart.
Excellent. Well, I think we can start wrapping things up here. But do you want to plug buyers and sellers and let people know how they can get in touch with you and how they can order wine?
Well, shameless plug right now. You can go to www.buyersandsellers.ca. Sellers is with a C. It's my little dad joke. Follow us on Twitter, on especially Instagram and Facebook. But you know what I really want to give a plug to? Is, again, go out to restaurants. They're my best customers as well as my friends. Support local, please. Support people that have good hiring practices and treat their employees well, and continue to spend that disposable cash on our local restaurants. That's more important than anything to me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I didn't realize we were going to be recording this on a holiday Monday, but that's I did okay. It. So, although holidays mean nothing anymore because every day is the same. So,
hey, next you promised me day drinking. So next time,
yes, we that's drink right. I didn't. Okay. Well, next time. All right. Okay, well, thank you so much and have a great day.
Thanks, Chef. You too.
Thank you for listening to At the Pass. Don't forget to hit subscribe and leave a nice review, and feel free to get in touch. My email is adam@northandnavy.com.